though I hate to talk.
Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we chat about Harvey at Studio 54, and Miss Reardon drinks a little at the Longview Theater, Man and Superman at the Irish Rep, As You Like It at the Delacorte in Shakespeare in the Park, and we talk about the history of Shakespeare in the Park. In the news, we talk a little bit about Audra McDonald. She's out of Porgy and Bess for vocal rest, and Max von Essen is going in as Shay for Ricky Martin while Ricky Martin's on vacation. So we chat about that and a bunch of other things in and around the Broadway community. Please listen to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Thanks.
My life is Hades, evading ladies that asked me out to tea. Gloria Swanson's hot for me. Look at the stud she got for me. And Mary Pickford sent me a trick Ford and sent it FOB.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway for Sunday, June 24th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Michael is a writer and photographer. You can see his writing and his photography at followspotphoto.com. You can also see him, his writing and his photography at broadwaystars.com. Michael also writes for outlets such as Arts America and NPR.org. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Also with us is Peter Felicia. Peter is a writer. You could read his writing at the New York Star Ledger, kind of all the days of the week, Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, Critchaland on Fridays, the MTI blog throughout the month, and every now and then Peter puts out a book. Isn't that correct, Peter?
Yeah.
All right. We've talked sideways about your book on Tony Losers a bunch of times, but how's that going? When's that scheduled for? Is it going to be a stocking stuffer?
By no means. They want it to come out next year at the Tonys, so it's going to be that week. So June of 2013, which will be here before we know it, but I've got to get it done by, at the very latest, September 1st. So I'm working. I'm working.
Which company is it, Peter?
St. Martin's Press.
Oh, great.
Great. Well, gosh, Labor Day.
That's right. It will be laborious.
Yes, you got to cut down trees, tall trees, to make thick books. Alrighty. So we had a Broadway opening. I guess it's the first of the new season. Harvey, is that correct? Is the first of the new season?
Probably.
I think so.
Well, you know, last season we started off with Spider-Man. So Harvey started off. So Peter, tell us, are we in the right direction from Spider-Man to Harvey, or...
Oh, no question about that. I think Harvey is one of the greatest comedies ever written because it's unique. There's nothing quite like it. It's as skillful to me as a Chekhov play. And I know that's quite a statement, and I'll try to back it up. But my feelings about Harvey involve the fact that we're talking about imagination here. And that's what Harvey, the rabbit, the pooka, represents, imagination and fanciful whimsy, the part of ourselves that we later came to call the inner child. And a lot of us lose that. And this comes through Elwood P. Dowd, who finds delight in the smallest things. And that's what I love about him, that he's such a nice person. But more to the point, when he meets somebody, he is automatically interested in that person. He does not think about class distinctions or anything like that. More importantly, he really finds people natively interesting. No matter how small the detail, when he meets a cab driver and finds out that the cab driver has a brother who's a cab driver, they work for different companies, he's fascinated. And he makes us really stop and think, why aren't we more fascinated with people? Why don't we give people more time? Why are we so quick to just brush people off when really everybody has a fascinating story? And Elwood's ready to listen to that. And Harvey is one of the reasons why. He really opens up his eyes, I think, or Elwood has opened his own eyes and has found this 6 foot plus rabbit, Pooka, as mythological name, and he just welcomes it into his life, and perhaps we all should welcome a Harvey into our life. Now, there's one big flaw with the play, and I wish it weren't there, and that is the fact that Elwood drinks a lot. I mean, a lot. Well, we never see him take a drink, but I am telling you, the conversation turns to liquor endlessly with him. And you run the risk of saying, oh, he's just a drunk. He's just an alcoholic. There's even a reference to an encyclopedia entry about Puka that says they are very fond of rum pots. You know, and I do think that's injurious to the play because I don't want it to be at all that Elwood is experiencing the DTs. That's, I think, really, really bad for this play. But I would just love that he goes to bars all the time. And I don't mind him going to bars. I just wish he weren't drinking. I think it would be charming if he went to bars and ordered ginger ale. And that would really be wonderful. And that would take care of that problem, that he goes to bars to meet people, not to drink. But unfortunately, he does talk about let's go have a drink quite a bit. So that is a problem. Now, the production. Jim Parsons is really quite good. He really has the innocence. He really has the wonderfully lightheaded, sincere, earnest quality that is needed for this role. So I thought he was really quite good, and I enjoyed him immeasurably. Jessica Hecht is very atypically cast, and it may be because many of us know Josephine Hull in her Oscar-winning performance in the movie, and maybe we're used to a shorter, squatter lady. In fact, there was a TV version. I first saw the TV version in 1958 with Art Carney playing Elwood, and Marion Lorne, if anybody knows who she was, who was a dithery lady. And Jessica Hecht is a trim lady, and she doesn't have that squat, rotund look to her. So it's a little atypical. And for those of us who know Harvey, it's a little hard to get used to seeing somebody of that more diminutive size turn out to be our Vida Louise. Tracy Chimo, an actress I really, really liked. She was so phenomenal in Bachelorettes up at Uptown Second Stage some time ago. Plays Myrtle May, and I think she's terrific too. Now, Vida and Myrtle May, in case you don't know the play, think that they better get Elwood, Vida's brother, Myrtle May's uncle, into a sanitarium really quick because he is nuts. And it doesn't quite work out as smoothly as they think. And we find out that they are a little more prejudiced and a little more evil than we thought. I mean, Vida keeps on talking about he talks to people you wouldn't want to know. And Myrtle May has her eye on the house. It's actually Elwood's house. It was left to him in a will. And she's making plans for when he's in that sanitarium. So she's not so nice. Charles Kimbrough, who we haven't seen in a while, plays the head of the sanitarium. And he's quite delightful. And he comes around to seeing a little bit more of Harvey than he expected. So I liked him quite a bit, too. It's a good revival. It's a good one. It's not a great one. I won't say that. But the chance to see it and the fact that there are about, what, a dozen people in it? I mean, you know, it's nice that Roundabout spent the money on it. The set is quite lovely, both sets, in fact, and they dovetail very nicely. David Rockwell did a very nice job with that. So it is definitely worth a visit. If you can't get to it, however, do see that marvelous James Stewart movie. It's terrific. There are some scenes in the movie, of course, when they try to open it up, but almost every time they open it up, they do something really quite wonderful. So failing getting to Studio 54, get the picture.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Well, as I think I mentioned a few weeks ago, I went into this production completely cold. I had never read or seen Harvey in any way, shape, or form. And I do like to do that sometimes.
Oh, I do.
Yeah, well, you know, but especially in your case, Peter, you know, and in mine to a great degree. There aren't that many classics,
sure,
you know, that I have not ever seen. But this one, just for whatever reason, it just always escaped me. And so it was really fascinating to go in 2012, you know, and just experience cold this play from what year was it?
45.
Yeah, you know. I found it really, really interesting. But I actually, Peter, I'm really wanted to ask you about it because I don't think it's completely clear what the playwright is saying. I think there are a lot of interesting things there, but I'm not sure exactly what the point is supposed to be, if there is supposed to be a point, and if she is trying to say something specific.
Well, I will tell you this. The cab driver who comes in at the end of the show, he has a very important line, and the way Scott Elliott blocked it, it really killed the line. At least, you know, of course, where you're sitting often has a vantage point with that, too. But anyway, I'll give away a bit of the play. There is a scene where Vita says, give him this drug that will make him stop seeing Harvey. And a cab driver comes in and gives a very nice speech. And at the end of it, he says, I'm telling you this, after he has that injection, he'll just be a normal, ordinary human being.
Right, right.
And you know what bastards they are. And that's what it really comes down to. And that's, I think, the whole point of the play. Go ahead, Michael.
Oh, yeah. No, I got that. And it's interesting to think of like similar plays that make similar. I was struck by the fact that one could see it as one could see it as akin to the Iceman Cometh of all things. Iceman Cometh is about how what do they keep calling it? The great pipe lie. You know, the
dreams. Literally pipe dreams.
Pipe dreams. The things that help people get through the day. And in that case, it's the fact that Hickey pretends to have a really happy marriage when in fact he's killed his wife. In this case, it's something very different. But what I meant was, it's so interesting what you said to me before about Harvey as a character, and it is true. He's so wonderfully open and interested and childlike in a good way, and so when people say, you know, oh, we should get together for lunch sometime, he says, when would you?
Because
you
we know, all say it.
Because we he really say, wants
sure,
to.
Oh, I'd love to get together. Oh, that'd be great. Yeah. But we never make plans. This guy means it. He makes plans.
But
he
tell
wants
me this,
to see you.
But tell me this, Peter. Wouldn't it seem to you that someone like that would be the least likely person to need to have an imaginary friend?
But there are things in the play that suggest that Harvey is an imaginary. And I know we get into sticky territory here. Believe me, I do.
Well, that's interesting because, yes, I mean, I think without giving spoilers, it's fair to say that there are times when no one is on stage and we see things that make us sense Harvey's presence. It took me a while to figure out what the player I was trying to say with that. And what I took away from it is that we all have our own Harvey.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, we need them. Well, we should have them. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And the world would be a better place if we had a little more of Harvey and Elwood in us. So that's what really fascinates me about this play. And I think it's so magnificent an idea to open up your horizons. That maybe the reason we don't see pukas is because our eyes cannot take them in, because our eyes are too closed to take them in. See, I think that that indeed Harvey is real. Yes, we see him turn pages in a book. Yes, we see him come in and make an entrance. We see doors open, that type of thing. We also see him leave his hat at one point. We don't see him leave his hat. We see his hat. I should say that. And the other thing that's interesting about him coming in, coming out, all that kind of business, is at the very end, there's something involving a change purse that involves Harvey as well. So that's significant. By the way, a historical note. People always say, oh, if you could go back in time and see anything, what would you see? And you always hear Follies and Funny Girl and Gypsy and all that kind of stuff. I would have loved to have been at Harvey. First performance in Boston, where it tried out in 1945, going in like Michael did, not knowing anything, because when you see Elwood come in and say, right over here, Harvey, you know, sit down, rest, you know, all that kind of business, it must have been astonishing. I would love to hear that laugh in the theater when she's at the doctor's office and he says, tell me about Harvey. And she says, he's a rabbit. Because up until that point, we wouldn't have assumed, oh, it must be a rabbit. We assume Harvey is a person. That must have got such a titanic laugh. I mean, today, Michael, even though you went in cold, I'm sure you knew Harvey was a rabbit, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So imagine what it must have been like back then when that happened. By the way, at the first performance of Harvey, and only the first performance of Harvey in Boston, Harvey was played by an actor in a rabbit suit. And in that second act scene where he comes in through the door and then goes out the other door, he actually was in a rabbit suit. And people felt, you know, no, this has got to be about imagination. It's got to be about that. We cannot literally see Harvey. That is so important to make sure you do not see him. And after one performance, $600 of rabbit suit, you know, was down the drain.
Well, that's funny. The person I went with said that he thought it would have been funny if Harvey came out only in the curtain call.
Harvey did come out in the curtain call in the original and in the James Stewart revival that I saw in 1970.
Oh. Yes,
they did. They actually all gestured, much the way the cast of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang gestured to the car, which was really there, of course. But, I mean, that type of gesture. And the audience loved it. I mean,
I meant somebody in a 6 foot tall.
Oh, I see. Oh, all right. Yeah. I see. Okay.
I mean, obviously that, you know. It really is very interesting to me. But I guess what I'm saying is if we're meant to think that Harvey is imaginary, then the play means something quite different than if we're meant to think he's not imaginary. And so because that's not clear, I would say that maybe that's a flaw, but I could see why you don't see it that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I will say I adored Jessica Hecht, although it took me a while to get used to her because she used a sort of an upper crust American society accent that I'd never heard her use before, and it was entirely appropriate. She got the biggest laugh of the show, and actually one of the biggest laughs I've heard on Broadway recently. I don't think it's a spoiler because you have to hear her do it. At one point, you know, now mind you, this is the woman who wants to have Elwood put away because he has this imaginary friend. And yet we come to realize that maybe she has come to believe in Harvey as well.
That's right.
And at one point, they're trying to get, I think the doctor is trying to get Elwood to come back to the house and, Or no, he's on the phone or something, and he says something like, the doctor says to Vida, says, "Well, tell him that Harvey's here," and she says, "But he isn't." And I swear, I don't know about the night you went, Peter. The audience laughed for a solid minute.
Really? Oh, that's wonderful.
Oh, it was.
No, they
so
didn't quite do that in my performance. They enjoyed the joke, of course, but it wasn't a solid minute. Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Oh, it was great. You know, one of those great laughs that just starts and just goes through the whole house, and then like some people stop laughing, and then but then like
somebody
other people start. Yeah, right. And it was great. It was a great. I would have loved the production if only for that one moment. But there are really a lot of wonderful things in it, and especially Jim Parsons, and Charles Kimbrough is one of my all time favorites. He really, really is. I saw him as did you get to see him as Pickering in that concert version of My Fair Lady?
Yeah. No, I did. It was nice to hear him get entrance applause, as well as Larry Brigman, who played the judge.
Yes.
Applause, too. And I was very impressed by that, because it's nice to know that an audience knows who Larry Brigman is, who, by the way, I used to see in Boston, in Theater Company of Boston back in the 60s. I saw him do Tiny Alice and a number of other things. So he was really special to me, and so I'm just delighted that his career has continued for so long and has really accelerated rather than declined. So good for him.
All righty. So we'll go from a possible drinking man into a possible drinking woman, Michael. Is it? And Miss Reardon drinks a little at Longview Theater. Why don't you tell us about that?
By Paul Zindel. And here again, never read it, never saw it. I mean, it's considerably less popular than Harvey.
It is.
And the play was, it came after Zindel's Pulitzer Prize winner, The Effect of Gamma Rays on Man in the Moon, Marigolds. And it's, I won't say much about it. It's a very odd play. I think he was trying to go in a kind of a more absurdist direction. I don't know if that's the proper word, but it's certainly not a realistic play, I would say. It's very, very over the top. A lot of things happen that are heightened reality, to say the least, even the way that a gun is used in the production. And this is one of those shows where we got a warning before the product, you know, somebody came up and in the speech beforehand, they said, you know, gunshots will be heard. And I'm like, oh, well, great, you know. So I always think it's odd when they have to tell you that beforehand. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, so many people do get unnerved by that. But on the other hand, when you go into a show and you see that sign beforehand, and then somebody pulls out a gun, you know what's going to happen as a result of that sign.
And more importantly, before they pull out the gun, you're sitting, if you're someone who's really bothered by it, you're sitting there saying, oh, shit, when is the gun?
When are they going to bring out the gun? Yeah, yeah, it's true.
But anyway, so very odd play. I thought it was... quite a good production by this new company called Longview Theater. It seems to have been created by a bunch of graduates of NYU Tisch School of the Arts. But there was, you know, I guess they did it for themselves, and you know, which is fine. But there was, it led to some miscasting, I thought, including the fact that the woman who played one of the roles seemed considerably younger than she should have been, and kept referring to one of her other sisters as, you know, the younger sister, when she looked several years younger than her. And I thought, well, what did they do that for? I mean, isn't it obvious to them that she looks the wrong age? And it may sound like a minor point, but it's because it's brought up several times.
All right. Now, I saw it way back when, the original production, when it tried out in Boston, and I remember Julie Harris, and I remember Estelle Parsons, and I remember Nancy Marchand, and Bill Macy, not to be confused with William H. Macy. And I remember at least two of them were school teachers. Is that what?
That's right, yes.
And what goes on? I have very little memory of it.
Well, it's...
not it's, much, huh?
Well, oh, one interesting thing is that one of the sisters, and then also another character who was referred to, another female teacher, there's mention of them being doing sexually inappropriate things with their students.
Oh, that's interesting.
I thought, you know, one could write volumes because Zindel was gay, and I don't know if he was openly gay during his life. I don't think so, but I believe that he was, and I was. I mean, I just, you don't really hear that often, especially in those days, about female teachers,
right.
You know. So I guess maybe he wrote it that way because he didn't want to go there and write about a male teacher.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, all I'm saying is that men in general, I think, tend to be sexual predators much more than women, whether they're straight or gay men. So that struck me as really interesting. And it's just about the why one of the teachers has left the school. And the interesting thing for me is that it's set on Staten Island, where Paul Zindel lived for
many years.
And so there were a couple of references, including a reference to a gas station that I've been to. So that kept it interesting, but very the characters are extremely unsympathetic and unpleasant, and
I remember somebody eating chopped meat from a box, from a candy box.
Yeah, you don't know what's going on. Like this delivery boy delivers raw chopped meat, and one of the characters puts it in a candy box because, I guess, to hide it, because one of the other sisters is an adamant vegetarian. But if she's hiding it, but then she takes it out and she's eating from it in front of her. So it's like, well, what is that all about? And why would she put it in a candy box, you know, rather than refrigerate it? it seemed weird.
All right. So
I want to say a couple of things about this, though, and that is the fact that this was a play that Paul Zindel had written beforehand, before he had written his it won a Pulitzer Prize. Did it? Gamma Rays?
Oh, yeah. I mentioned that. So you're saying it was produced afterwards, but written
yes.
Before.
And this is the classic case of when a playwright hits it big, that suddenly producers are saying, what else you got? And that's why these things happen. What else you got? Everybody's interested in your next play after you have hit it big. And many times those next plays are plays that you have in your draw. And as a result, it can often work out terribly for producers when they do that type of thing. I did a survey. I'm looking for it now. I'm finding it. But anyway, about what's the difference between a play that won a Tony and then the playwright's next play. So how many performances the average Tony-winning play ran, and then how many the follow-up ran. And, I mean, it really is amazing to see the difference. All right, here it is. The Tony-winning plays wound up running a total of 897 months, all right, while the follow-up plays ran 205 months. So that's very interesting to me. I mean, that's really quite a substantial difference. It's more than 4-1. This, by the way, is only as far as I did the article when Richard Greenberg had The Violet Hour, which was not a big success, following Take Me Out, which was a big success. So that statistics only got up till that moment. But anyway, 897 to 205. So I really do believe that it has to do with the fact that producers suddenly say, oh, this guy's a great writer. What else has he got? And that can get everybody in trouble.
Well, let's see here. I have it here. Oh, no, I don't have it here. That was a revival. Miss Reardon only ran 108 performances.
So right.
It did not go over that. No. But what a cast.
You bet.
Julie Harris, Estelle Parsons, and Nancy Marchand were the three sisters. The three sisters. talk about Chekhov. Ray Allen.
Ray Allen was in it, too. That's right. Yeah.
And Bill Macy, from who we all know from Maud.
Maud, yeah.
And Paul Lieber and Virginia Payne. So, what a cast.
All right. Next on the agenda, Peter ran over to Ira Shrepp to see Man and Superman. So, Peter, why don't you give us a rundown on that?
Well, it's funny. I ran into David Stoller, the director, beforehand, and I said, are you doing Don Juan in Hell? Because Don Juan in Hell is an act of Man and Superman that sometimes is done and sometimes isn't. It's a fanciful representation of what we've been seeing all along with the other characters. But many productions drop it, and for that matter, there have been productions of Don Juan in Hell that they've simply done as a one act, usually as a reading, by the way. In fact, I saw it in the 70s with Paul Henreid, the guy from Casablanca, and Ricardo Montalban, a lot of good people. But anyway.
And in fact, I think that David Stoller did it not too long ago at Project Shaw.
Yeah, he does that. He's had a mission to do all of Shaw's plays as readings. And has done them all, I believe, and now is in his second go-round with them. So anyway, I saw him beforehand, and I know him because he's actually had me perform in two of his readings. So so I said, are you doing Don Juan in Hell? Knowing the answer would be yes, you know, because he's such a Shavian fan. So he said, oh, yeah. I said, so we're in for a long night. And he said, you know, actually, this whole thing rings in at 2 hours and 36 minutes. However, you won't get out of here till 11 o'clock, and the show started at 8, because the lines for the restrooms are so long. Irish Rep does have, unfortunately, they do wonderful work, but they have the worst restroom facilities in town.
We've discussed.
That's it, you know, and their audience tends to be old and needs those restrooms. So anyway, the point is, to get that down to 236, the pace has to be good. And it can't be rushed either. That wouldn't be any good either. There's a guy in Rhode Island who insists that every show he directs has to be under 2 hours. And I mean, I have seen dramas there that were that are played like situation comedy. David hasn't done that. He really has remained true to the play, and it really is a very, very, very skillful production. More to the point, it has, I think, a performance that is truly memorable, and that is by an actor named Max Gordon Moore. Do you know this guy?
No, I don't. Michael?
No.
Michael. I have to admit that I had never heard of him that I know of, but he was just delightful as Jack Tanner. Now, Jack is somebody who is a single man and enjoys being a single man. And nevertheless, you know, there is some interest here and there about... about a woman who could very well, you know, ring his chime if he'd allow it to happen. But nevertheless, he's going to be a little standoffish about it, and there's going to be a little push-me-pull-you going on here between both of them. And that's kind of interesting. But he is so delightful in the way that he delivers the Shavian feelings and philosophies about life, about religion. It's all there. There's a great deal about religion in this play, which is really tremendously pungent and a lot of food for thought. It starts out with the entire cast reading from a book. They pass the book from one to the other. Blink, 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 one to the other. And they read little quotations from George Bernard Shaw. And that's really quite nice because some of those quotations are amazingly pungent. You're going to recognize a number of these quotations as things you've heard your entire life. And you're going to say, ah, I didn't know where that came from. That's great. And that's always fun when that happens. So, and he does that during the scene changes. He has them go back to that book and keep on quoting from this play and others things that have happened. But anyway, the story is really about Anne. Her father died, and what she didn't realize is that he gave control to two men to be her guardians. And one is Jack, who's young and is full of beans and full of new ideas and new philosophies, while the other is Brian Murray, who is an old man who has very conservative ideas. So you have the nice push-me-pull-you there, too, because you're not really sure which one she's going to believe, which one she's going to go with, because she was a very obedient girl. She did everything her father told her. But now that her father has said to her, you have two guardians, wow, she doesn't know what to do. So as a result, she has to find her own psyche, her own personality, and that's part of the fun of the play. And it is fun. That's what's so interesting. This is one of the most entertaining Shavian productions I have ever seen. It really has a deft, light touch. I mean, so many people think of Shaw as talky and boring, and it didn't happen here. And it was so funny because I realized this was the fifth production of Man and Superman I saw, and it was like a whole new experience for me. I even saw it at the Shaw Festival, where you would think that they would do an exemplary production. And in fact, of course, they did Don Juan in Hell. You have to do it up there. I mean, at the Shaw Festival up in Niagara-on-the-Lake. But nevertheless, this one, I'm not going to say it played like situation comedy because that sounds like a left-handed compliment if it's a compliment at all. But it had such a deft touch that it didn't seem long. The lines for the restroom seemed long. But it was just delicious, delightful. And I was just tremendously taken with it. One thing, if you go, see if you think that Brian Murray – and David, for that matter, have been influenced by Harvey Fierstein. I saw a little Harvey Fierstein in Brian Murray's performance. That's neither a compliment nor a knock, but nevertheless, I saw some readings that struck me very much as the way Harvey would do them. So I think that would be very interesting. So anyway, a very, very surprising evening, because many of us go to this play with a sense of duty as opposed to a sense of, boy, this is going to be a great time tonight. Wow, can't wait to get there. But actually, I think you're going to be glad you came.
Great. Good endorsement there. And Irish Rep just knocks him out of the park consistently.
Yeah, it's a very good company. It really, really, really is.
Love to talk about them every couple of months to show us what's happening there. Michael, speaking of knocking him out of the park, are they knocking him out of the park at the Delacorte? Got there to see As You Like It?
James, can I just say I love your segues. I really
I channel the inner 70s television host as much as I can. So
I don't know how you do. I don't know how long you prepare, or if they're just spontaneous. But
they're generally spontaneous. I intend to prepare every week, and I two kids, no preparation.
Right.
We just roll with it. So, Michael, as you like it. Before that, did we talk about the Romeo and Juliet one night only thing last week? Or was that after we recorded?
I don't know if, I mean, I don't imagine any of us saw it.
I didn't.
No, but the girls from the Craptacular got in. I don't know.
They did.
They snuck in.
Oh, I see.
They snuck in, and they had, you know, if you go over to the craptacular.com, they've got very funny things to mention about that. But anyway, yeah. As you like it, since we didn't see Romeo and Juliet, as you like it, tell us about your experience there. First of all, start with the weather to give us the scenario.
That's funny you ask, because invariably when I go to see Shakespeare in the Park, it rains. But not the night I saw this. It was a beautiful, beautiful night. One of the most beautiful nights I can remember. Sunny during the day, but then it cooled off just a little bit at night, and there was a lovely breeze, and it was really great. Wonderful production, directed by Daniel Sullivan, one of the best. The interesting thing to me about this is that it did not start off well. For the first 15 or 20 minutes, I was like, oh boy, I think maybe they missed the boat. And that's largely because this is a very unusual play. Well, actually not unusual, because a lot of Shakespeare is like this, but it's a comedy that's very, very dark in places. And in this case, it's very, very dark at the beginning. It opens up with a conflict, a very serious conflict between two brothers, and a violent conflict, really, almost. And I thought that... that combined with a certain deliberateness of the pacing of the dialogue, it seemed very, very heavy for the first two or three scenes. But then starting when Lily Rabe came on in the role of Rosalind, and Renee Elise Goldsberry as Celia, really two wonderful actresses, then it started to... kick into the lightness and the comedy. And Oliver Platt, I hasten to say, gave a really very touching and hilarious performance as Touchstone, the clown. I thought that he himself was quite good in Guys and Dolls. I noticed when I saw that debacle that things were falling around him, but I thought that he really got the style of it. And here again, he does. Shakespeare's clowns and fools tend to be very difficult to play nowadays, because a lot of their comedy is not something that strikes modern ears as funny because of the things they're referring to and the kind of language that they use. But he was truly funny. He really, really was. And the set is amazing. The park is used beautifully to show. There's a huge, I don't know if it's actually wooden, but it certainly looks like a huge wall of wooden posts that is meant to represent the scenes in the court. And then when we go into the Forest of Arden, these two huge, huge tall walls kind of part and kind of slide off where you can't see them anymore. And you're left with nothing but vegetation, you know, real vegetation on stage, amongst which the cast acts and frolics and does their thing. Really, really beautifully well done. I actually heard that the first week or so there were a lot of tickets available for the show, and you could actually waltz up right beforehand and get in. I think maybe that was, I'm hoping that was because of the weather being so iffy at the time. From day to day, you never knew what the hell was going to happen next with the weather. I hope it wasn't because, you know, it's I hope it wasn't because there were no TV stars in the show. The public does. I mean, the public does tend to get major, not just TV stars, but movie stars like Meryl Streep and Kevin Kline and Christopher Walken and Anne Hathaway and Natalie Portman and so on and so on. There's really no major movie or TV star in this show, just really excellent actors. And I think there are probably not empty seats anymore, because I think word has gotten around that it's a beautiful production. I should also mention Steven Spinella in a very skilled and tremendously moving performance as Jake Wees, who's sort of the odd man out amongst the people in the Forest of Arden, and Andre Brower playing both Duke Frederick and Duke Senior. I don't think I've ever seen that done before.
I don't think I have either.
But a very interesting idea, they are never on stage at the same time, so mm-hmm. it works. Mm-hmm. It works wonderfully well, and he really created two very, very distinct characters. I have to say, very impressive. McIntyre Dixon is in it. Our friend Donald Lynn Champlin is a delight as Audrey, who's a goat herd, a wonderful little character. And Will Rogers, and the new Will Rogers, just really great. I would recommend it if you can get there. Especially on a night when the weather was as lovely as when I saw it.
It's great to see that stuff. What Joe Papp has done over 50 years, and his legacy lives on there. It's amazing. Can you guys give us some color about some of the first productions that you've seen in the park?
Well, I know. I just want to say NPR just did a lovely little feature on it on the radio, and because as I think maybe most of us know, the night this past Monday, which was the night of the All-Star Romeo and Juliet reading with Meryl Streep and Kevin Kline, was the exact 50th anniversary of the first performance in the park. That must have been really cool to be there that night. And the first one, I believe, was The Merchant of Venice with George C. Scott.
Was that was the park's first one? That wasn't your first one, was it?
Oh, no. No, I wish it had been. Yeah.
Yeah. So what was your first one? What was the first time you saw something?
Mine, I believe, was Three Penny Opera. There was a production of Three Penny Opera at Lincoln Center in 1976. And Joe Papp was running Lincoln Center at that time, and losing interest in it. It was too much for him. So he just picked up that production, which had been charging top dollar, and brought it to the park and gave it to everybody for free. And I had seen the production in the Beaumont Theater the previous year, but it was fun to see it again outside. There's something magical about sitting out there. There really is. Two experiences come to mind immediately, and one involved the fact that there we were watching some Shakespeare play one night. I do not remember the play, when all of a sudden the cat strolled onto the stage, and suddenly it stopped mid-walk, the paw still in the air, ready to take the next step. And that cat looked around and said, "Oh my God, I'm in trouble." You know what I mean? He couldn't believe, you know, with all these lights and all these people looking at him, what did I just walk into? I mean, so I remember that quite fondly. The other thing I remember fondly in a way, yes and no, but mostly yes, is when I went to see Meryl Streep do The Seagull a few years ago. And Michael, you think it rains when you go? Let me tell you,
It rained when I went to that.
Well, it was a monsoon the night that I went. And I mean, we were just soaked, but it's Meryl Streep. And it's, you know, I mean, we got to stay. And finally, after about an act, they said, we have to stop. I mean, it's just too terrible. And they gave us all tickets for another performance. So as a result, we got to see the play and a little bit more of it too, this hot, 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 hot ticket, because the weather didn't cooperate. And while we all went home and had to put everything to dry, I mean, just drenched all of us. The fact remains that it was worth it to see that little bit of The Seagull and then get to see it on a good night as well.
I think it sounds like we might have been at the same performance.
Really?
Well, the night I went, I'll never forget it. well, maybe not. The night I went, it was threatening and like drizzling for the whole first section of the show. And immediately after Meryl Streep made her entrance, it started to freaking pour.
And did they stop it?
They stopped it, yeah.
Probably were there the same night.
Yeah, and I did get to go back. A friend of mine, the one who I brought to see As You Like It, always tells this. He's told it to several times to several people because it made such an impression on him. Last year, he went to see Twelfth Night, which ends with David Pitu as the fool in that play singing a song about, I forget exactly which lyric it is, because a lot of Shakespeare has actually a lot of songs about the elements, but I think it's "The Rain, It Raineth Every Day."
Oh,
is that right?
Oh, yeah.
And he said, and my friend Bill Coyne said that it was threatening all night, you know, really threatening, and everyone could tell, you know, people kept looking up. You could feel it in the air that it was waiting to rain, and David Pitu could feel it too, and he started, you know, it was the very end of the play, and he started the song, and just as he started, it started to pour, and he sang the song in the rain. Can you imagine?
Wow.
Can you recall if the public has ever done Singing in the Rain in the Park?
Yeah, it doesn't sound like something they do. On the other hand, they did On the Town, you know, so...
Well, I was going to mention that. I'm glad you brought that up, because I wanted to ask how you see the changes in artistic leadership at the public and how it affects the productions in the park.
Well, I guess a case could be made, since we're going to be seeing Into the Woods, though Into the Woods is a darker musical than many's, but it has come to become a popular success. I'm fine with bringing other things into the park besides Shakespeare. I don't think Shakespeare should be eliminated, needless to say, and that hasn't happened this year either. I'm pretty sure there was a time when they did three in the summer. I could
be
wrong.
That sounds right. Yeah.
You know, so I would like to see that happen again, rather than just two. But we're lucky to have two. It wouldn't even bother me tremendously if it was just one, if it was a real knockout, tremendous cast type of thing that would be of interest to a summer's worth of New Yorkers and tourists. That would be all right with me, too. But there was something about going to that park three times in the summer rather than two that was a lot of fun. And I like that immeasurably, because... there is something magical about sitting in that outdoor theater, even when it's terribly humid and hot. I've had that experience too. But after a while, the magic that happens on stage takes over, and you forget that it's so humid and hot.
It's interesting to hear actors talk about it too, as they did on the NPR feature I mentioned. People find it hard to put into words, because you can't really explain it. It's a combination of reasons why it's so magical there, and you're... The audience is so focused. Oh, Jonathan Groff, who did a show there a couple of years ago, made the point that everybody who's there really, really wants to be there, because you have to wait online, you know, in most cases, you have to wait online for tickets for a long time. And it's not that he said it's not the kind of thing that, you know, guys let their girlfriends drag them to, because it just doesn't work that way. And so the fact that everyone in the audience is so invested in it, that makes a tremendous difference. Plus the setting and the magic.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. It really does.
My first show, I think, as I remember, was the famous Pirates of Penzance. So of course they have been doing non-Shakespearean things for quite some time.
And yeah, Edward Drood.
Yeah,
Edwin Drood was there too.
And I think they've had a good balance. I don't have any objection really to where the theater is going under Oscar Eustace. I think he's doing a very good job overall. There are some things that one might possibly question as being too commercial, but you know, I mean, let's face facts, guys.
Let's face facts indeed. Yeah. And by the way, I mean, let's face facts in another way too. Reason Joe Papp started doing Shakespeare is because he didn't have to pay the playwright.
Right.
you know, so if there's money available to pay writers, that's a nice thing.
Absolutely.
You know, so I imagine Stephen Sondheim isn't hurting for money. I'll grant you that. And I imagine James Lapine isn't either. But nevertheless, they worked hard on Into the Woods. They made it a success. There was a time during previews it looked like it wasn't going to work out at all. So, I mean, so they're entitled to some money and good for them, you know. So, and, you know, it's very nice when a revival like Hair goes in there, too. And guys who haven't seen it. Very much income from their show, their big hit of 1968. And, you know, it really must gall creative people who had a hit 40 years ago when tickets were like 10 bucks. You know, how much could they have made? I mean, I'll grant you, if you had a big hit 40 years ago, you got a good piece of change. But imagine what you get now when tickets are so much more expensive, when you get 2% of the gross or whatever you get. You know, so so it's nice when revivals come back and can make more money for these people that they didn't get back then because ticket prices were lower.
Yeah. When I was asking about the artistic directors, I was really talking about George C. Wolfe and how he sort of turned very commercial and in my opinion, put the public theater in jeopardy with his gamble on the town.
Well, he thought, yeah, he thought, but he didn't even turn commercial in a wise way.
With the Wild Party and On the Town, those two shows.
Huge disasters.
Nearly put, in my opinion, put the public theater in jeopardy there.
Yeah.
So, but it's great to see everything back in full form there. And they've certainly had a handful of successes. And the Broadway production of Hair put some money back in the coffers for the public. And they have started, quote unquote, selling tickets to the park productions for a certain number of seats. Certainly there are still free seats available. But,
yeah, certainly.
But,
and that's not so outrageous either.
Yeah, everything's got to change with the times. And
well, another factor, too, is let's not forget that there were many, many productions in the late 70s at the Shakespeare, at the Public Theater downtown that would not have happened had that candy store called A Chorus Line at the Schubert been running. I mean, he really funneled back that money into doing a lot of experimental things, picking up shows from here and there. There was a theater called New Playwrights Theater in Washington. They had a play come up to New York and had a month or so run here, which would not have happened if Chorus Line hadn't been pulling in all that money. So the good thing about commercial hits in a not-profit arena is the fact that they can often make other things happen, and it's very nice when that happens, needless to say.
And as we've read, I believe that a sort of a new arrangement has been worked out. For example, when the public was involved with the commercial Broadway transfer of Hair, whereby they do benefit from it to a degree if it goes well, but their risk is extremely limited.
Well, I'm pretty sure that the board at the Public Theater put into place restrictions that said that they could no longer take risk on a commercial venture like that. And I think I think that the CFO of the Public Theater had changed, and there was some financial issues that happened down there, and the board stepped in and said this can no longer happen. And as we remember, you know, the first incarnation of Hair coming out of the park, Liz McCann was producing it. Couldn't raise the money. And there was no talk at that point, you know, that the Public Theater was going to pony up money.
Right.
Because it couldn't happen. Mm-hmm. So let's move forward here with a few words about the news. Audra McDonald, as we mentioned last week, is having some vocal problems, and she's out of Porgy and Bess for a few weeks, which is disrupted performances and box office, and it's interesting to see what's happening. Michael, do you just want to say something quickly about it?
Well, just that, you know, it's, I don't know. Nah. To me, it's karma in the sense that I don't think this thing was very thought out very well. When Porgy and Bess played Broadway in 1976, for example, they certainly had alternates for all of the, at least for Porgy and Bess, I think, and maybe for some of the other roles as well, because they are not intended to be sung 8 times a week. And when this production came about, Audra McDonald was a great deal of the engine, the muscle, you know, the raison d'etre behind it. And I think that maybe nobody really thought a lot as much as they should have when they were putting it together and planning to do it in Cambridge as to what was going to happen if the show moved to an open-ended commercial Broadway production, as was the plan from the beginning. And as I've said several times, I read a report that Audra did ask for an alternate when the Broadway production was in fact announced, and it was denied. So on the one hand, you have this star in this major star in this show, and we can assume that a very large percentage of the audience would go to see it for her, particularly, and would not want to see it so much if she's not in it. And here she is in a role in which she's supposed to be doing it 8 times a week, even though one should not be trying to do it 8 times a week. And so you have this kind of very destructive tension happening night after night, basically. And she did miss a couple of performances a few months ago, and then I think maybe another one or two later on. And now this absence is going to, when you total it all up, it's going to be, I believe, about 3 or 4 weeks. So that is, you know, I just think that maybe it could have been thought out better. But I despise the production, the revisal, so much that I in that sense, it doesn't really upset me that much. I don't want it to become established as the new Porgy and Bess. And if this prevents it from doing that, then that's one positive aspect of the very unfortunate situation.
Let's move to something more positive. Ricky Martin is going on vacation the week of July 4th, and Max von Essen is going to step in as Shay for Evita on Broadway. Michael has a feature coming up in Broadway Stars about that. You want to give us a preview?
Oh, yeah. I spoke to Max just yesterday, in fact, and he's going on, I believe, starting July 2nd or around there for a week. And he's looking forward to it because he went on for Che, I believe, not this past Wednesday, but the week before, and for two performances. And that was on no notice whatsoever. And he told me that although he had been rehearsed through the whole show, but as he explained, you know, when you rehearse through the show, you're rehearsing with one or two other people. Then eventually they have what they call a put-in where you do it with the entire cast, but they hadn't gotten to that yet. And he says it's really quite an experience to go on stage and do it for the first time with with everything, the orchestra and the costumes and the entire cast in front of an audience. So he said it was kind of an out-of-body experience, and you just kind of almost on you just in a way autopilot. I mean, just in the sense that you're just doing it. And you don't have time to think about, oh my God, what am I doing?
Well, it's funny because but what's it like when you're playing Magaldi and you hear Che say, "You'll never be remembered for your voice," you know, and now suddenly the shoe is on the other foot, and you are actually saying this to an actor who's playing your part that you've been doing every night. It's kind of interesting to me. By the way, "You'll never be remembered for your voice" is much harder to swallow when one hears Max von Essen singing. He really is very good. The album comes out this week, I believe. I've heard it. It's a very good album. I love the sound of it. It's quite an immediate sound that I really like. And while I didn't like Ricky Martin in the production because he didn't know what to do with his hands,
right,
well, not a problem on the recording. And while I didn't like Elena Rogers because she did seem to be too short, well, that's not a problem with the recording, you know. And by the way, that's a charge, of course, that also was leveled against Eve Harrington, too, that she was too short for a certain gesture. But nevertheless, it's a terrific recording. And I really like it, too, because it isn't a mirror image of the original Broadway cast. It's not much longer. It's only 6 minutes longer, and some of that is taken up with a bonus track of Miss Rogers singing in Spanish, Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. And, of course, as always is the case, once there's a movie of a show, you know where this is going, once there's a movie of a show, and a new song is added, virtually every revival, you know, takes that song and puts it in the stage production that comes next, you know. And so You Must Love Me, that Oscar winner, is in this recording. And it's a good song, you know, because Tim Rice was clever to use the word must in all those different ways. I command that you love me, you know, considering what I've meant to you, this is the feeling you have for me. Please, I beg you, love me. All that is there. So it's really quite a nice, nice recording. And a lot of stuff you don't hear on the other album, even though it's not that much longer. They've edited here and they've added there. So it's a different experience. And I love when that happens with revival cast albums. I don't want them to be the same original cast album, but with different voices. So so I think it's a success.
Well, the thing about... I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, Michael. You go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I apologize. The thing about you'll never be remembered for your voice. It's interesting. I asked Max about that because, in my estimation, in the original production of Evita, Magaldi was played as something of a joke. He's kind of like smarmy, and everyone's kind of making fun of him. Although the original singer, Mark Sires, had a very nice voice, so it's not true that he. It's certainly not true that he couldn't sing, but the character was played as a joke, and here it's played really very without any of that. And I asked Max if that was sort of his take, or if it happened with if that he was directed that way. And he said, in a nutshell, he said he did a lot of research on Magaldi, and he was a really very interesting character, and quite popular. To be honest, I didn't know that Magaldi was also an historic character. I didn't. I never bothered to find that out. I guess I thought maybe he was a composite, but no, he was not. He is not. So I think that's another great thing about revivals, when something just organically, when an actor and a director come up with a very different interpretation of a role that's equally valid but very different from the original.
Yeah, while I didn't see Merman and Gypsy, I wonder if she did what Patti LuPone did in the scene after its second act opens. The Toreadorables come out. They do their act. They're terrible. And the look on Patti LuPone's face was, how am I going to say to these kids anything positive? I just don't know how I'm going to do it. What words can I find that they will believe? And it was a wonderful moment. And again, maybe Merman had all that sympathy in her too. I have no idea. But nevertheless, I'm not sure she did. My guess would be she didn't. And so that was something that really impressed me. And I'd love to know anybody who saw Merman and Gypsy, which was before my theater going time, if indeed she did have that same type of take on it. But I wouldn't bet on it. So yeah, that's what's great about revivals, when you see something different. Do either of you know a song called Cherry Pink and Apple Blossom White?
No.
Okay.
I know of it, yeah.
I really believe that was Lloyd Webber's model for On This Night of 1,000 Stars. And anybody who knows that song, it's a 50s hit. And it was ubiquitous in the early 50s. And more to the point, it was the biggest challenge for a trumpet player to play. There was a big, wonderful elision that he had to do. But anyway, I think that was the model for Lloyd Webber's song, and if we ever shake hands, I'm definitely going to ask him.
So just before we wrap up the Max von Essen section, we should also mention that Daniel Torres is going to take over the part for one day. He's going to play the matinee and the evening performance on July 8th, so we don't want to slight Daniel.
He's a good actor.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's Daniel's been in Women in White, The Pirate Queen, A Christmas Carol at Madison Square Garden. He did Altar Boys off Broadway and did the national tour of Wicked. And he's been around at Pittsburgh Civic Light Opera, Sundance, La Jolla, Goodspeed, and Cleveland Opera. I mean, he's in and around. I guess maybe Max has taken a day off or something like that. But Ricky Martin returns in the 9th, and Daniel Torres is in the 8th. But the 2nd through the 7th is Max von Essen time. Max is he's so versatile. Every time I see him, he's so dramatically different from what I've seen him in previously. So next thing up on our agenda, we're quickly wrapping up here, is that Gilligan's Island is coming to Broadway, or so they say. I don't know what to say there.
I do. All right. Yeah? 15 years ago. We will do this in three acts. Okay. Act one. Peter enters and sees a producer he knows. Hi, producer. Hi, Peter. What's new, producer? Wait till you hear this. Wait till you hear this. Gilligan's Island, the musical. We start rehearsals in February. It's going to be great. Act two. February. Peter enters a party, sees producer. Hey, producer, how you doing? Good, good. Gilligan's Island, is it in rehearsal? No. We're actually September now. September, but it's going to be great. It really is. You know. Act three. September. Peter goes to a party. Producer. Hey, producer, how you doing? Long pause. How am I doing? I don't live in Biafra. I have my health. And indeed, Gilligan's Island was not happening. So, so boy, has this project been around for a long time.
Wow. I've heard of it, James. I did not.
Oh, at least 50. There's even an album. It was done in Australia, I think. I think I have the Australian cast album.
Oh, but when did word come that it's back?
It was in the New York Post a couple weeks ago.
Sure.
Oh, a few other
outlets mentioned it here and there, but basically picked up on the New York Post reporting. It's not intentionally campy, says producer Diane Fraser. Okay, the show written by the series' late creator Sherwood Schwartz and his son Lloyd, in fact, have been kicking around since 1989 when Workshop Productions were first produced on the West Coast. Okay, so I guess we will see about that. But more important than Gilligan's Island coming to Broadway is that, as Peter predicted, A Christmas Story is coming to Broadway. And in these days of 90 and 100-degree weather, let's talk about Christmas for a brief moment and reflect back to Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Yes, indeed. I did go to Hershey last fall to see A Christmas Carol, but I went to a tech rehearsal and only saw the first act, but loved it. It's by these guys, Benj Pasek and Justin Paul, who have this new musical, Dogfight, at Second Stage that's happening.
That's right, Dogfight.
Which we're looking forward to, but they really have a quintessential Broadway sound when they need to have it. They know exactly how to write for the characters they're writing for. And this, of course, is the famous Gene Shepherd story about the little boy who wants a gun as his Christmas present, and his parents are not enthusiastic about getting it for him. It's a BB gun, but nevertheless, they're not enthusiastic about it. And the score is delicious. I was so glad to see a tech rehearsal because there's one song called Ralphie to the Rescue that I love so much, and they had to do it over, and I was thrilled. And I would bet I've listened to that song 200 times in my CD player, and it's a parody of Western songs, you know, the Ghost Riders in the Sky, Elmer Bernstein, Magnificent Seven type song. So it really is very, very skillful. They're young people. They're not remotely 30, and they have so much talent. Graduates of Michigan, and I really believe they are going to be one of the great building blocks of the early 21st century in musical theater.
Well, I yesterday went to see, at the last moment practically, the beautiful Paper Mill Playhouse production of Once on This Island.
It is good, isn't it?
Partly on Peter's, because Peter raved about it so much. I wanted to go anyway, but that just spurred me on even more. And the friend I went with is the Christmas Story junkie that I've mentioned in the past, and he went to see it both. It was at Seattle and Chicago. Is that
right? It was in Chicago. I know. Yeah.
Yeah. He went to both places, and he is just thrilled. He loves it. He can't wait to see it on Broadway. He's so happy.
Yeah, that is significant when indeed it's somebody who loves the property, because so many times when a property is adapted, we're all disappointed because they left out X or they put in Y or they ruined it. You know, I mean, so it's really good when a true fan is enthusiastic about an adaptation.
What's interesting to me is I guess I'm a you know, as often is the case, I guess I'm in a minority in the sense that I never really warmed to the movie, because a lot of it to me is very kind of, I don't know if dark is the right word, but it's very kind of cynical. Cynical, is that the word? It's about like things that happen in a family when you're a kid that are not really terribly pleasant. And I guess that's why, I mean, it's certainly not a sentimental movie. I get, and I think that's the exact reason why so many people love it. But to me, it's a little bit in the opposite direction. But I would think that if a musical version might address my reservations with it in that sense and might lighten it to the point where I might find it really delightful and wonderful.
All right. So let's close out this morning by talking about three closings that we have today. Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, is closing, as well as Godspell, which is also having a tag sale. Get over there quickly to buy Jesus's original costume or something like that. And Off-Broadway Million Dollar Quartet is also closing. So
and last week... I didn't even quite realize it. I believe last weekend, Other Desert Cities closed. I was sitting actually right in front of Judith Light at Once on This Island yesterday, and I got to.
Don't you have a show, Judith? You have a show.
I was confused at first. I was like, "Gee, what do you do?" But and I was able to congratulate her on her Tony Award, and she was, you know, obviously very grateful. And actually, I went to high school with her dresser, her longtime dresser. He worked with her on this show and also on Lombardi, and I think maybe even before that. And she said she misses him already, and it's only been a week. Charlie Cadmeis is his name. I didn't. Did you guys realize that had closed?
No. Yeah. No, I have to admit I didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get.
Because when a show's a hit, you know, you don't expect it to disappear so fast, you know. But of course, this is the age of the limited engagement.
Death of a Salesman. Sure. Death of a Salesman could have run, you know, for another year.
Of course.
And, you know, I didn't know that technically Clybourne Park is a limited engagement. Did you know that?
Isn't that something? I didn't think that either. You know, but of course now with the extension to September 9th, we know that it's a limited engagement again, you know, so...
All right. So anything that we should mention before you guys bolt out for the Sunday afternoon activities?
Well, not to be repetitive, but I wanted to throw in yet another plug for the Most Happy Fella at DiCapo Opera Theater. I think I misspoke when we talked last week. It actually runs through July 8th. I thought it was a 3-week run, but it's a 4-week run. And it seems to be getting a kind of a... well, I don't want to say a viral following on Facebook and elsewhere as more and more people are discovering it. It's just an unbelievable thing. I mean, I was thinking a little more about it. There's almost nowhere else you can go to hear a classic musical with a full orchestra and, you know, professional level singers completely unamplified. You can't even go, even when City Opera did musicals, they didn't do them unamplified. They would bring in actual full amplification for the musicals alone. I guess when the Met did Porgy and Bess, that was a that was an example of if that's even a musical. But other than that, maybe small opera companies throughout the country, maybe they occasionally do musicals and maybe they do them unamplified, but I don't think so. I think even they do them with mics. So I mean, it's a once in a lifetime experience, except for DiCapo Opera, and they're doing Kismet next season, so I'm going to be there. I'm telling you that.
All right, Peter, what do you got going on?
I'm about to leave for Pennsylvania. I'm going to the Pennsylvania Shakespeare company to see Sweeney Todd. William Michaels, who has a lot of fans here, is playing Sweeney, so that should be of more than moderate interest. And it'll be something I can write about for my MTI column. Oh, speaking of MTI, I just wrote the obituary for Richard Adler. We should mention this. Richard Adler died on Thursday, and he was a bit of a buddy of mine. We got to know each other in the 90s, and so I was very sad to see this. It really does point out, though, that once you have the right chemistry with somebody, it's very hard to get it with anybody else, because we will never have this experience again where somebody wins two Tony Awards consecutively for shows that opened 357 days apart, not even a year. Pajama Game and then Damn Yankees, 357 days later. Both of them won Tonys. And this team, Adler and Ross, run the top of the world, except that November, 6 months later, Jerry Ross, who always was sick, always had a bronchial condition, literally vomited some of his lungs. I'm serious. And that was that. And Richard Adler's life was never the same.
At 29 years old.
29 years old. There's a very famous picture of Adler and Ross that's on every – the only time you see a picture of them, Adler is looking over his right shoulder. They're facing the camera, and he looks so young. I first saw that picture when I was 16 years old, and when I saw – I had read that he had died, and then I turned the page, saw the picture, and I said, he was so young! And the point was, he was 13 years older than I at that point, but nevertheless, even I at 16 could recognize – young, to die. So, I mean, it was really something. And Adler did a lot of things after that, and his score for Quamina, which only ran a month on Broadway, was nominated for a Tony, and Carnival was not, which was certainly a bigger hit, ran 20 times the run of Quamina. But it really is a fascinating score because it involves a great deal of tribal music in Africa, and those songs are spectacular. But nevertheless, Richard Adler, who also went to work for the Kennedy administration, and at a party said to Marilyn Monroe, why don't you sing Happy Birthday, Mr. President? That's how that happened. So he was quite a guy. And I will never forget the time I came into his house and took off my winter coat and almost knocked a ceramic off a shelf, you know. And I didn't think much of it till I went to Barcelona and I went to the Picasso Museum and saw those ceramics there. And I asked, I said, is that a Picasso? He said, yeah, I bought it in Mallorca in 1950. I almost talked over a Picasso. Oh, my God. You know, so anyway, rest in peace, Richard.
Yeah,
nice guy.
Oh, I'm so sorry I didn't put that in the lineup. I'm glad you remembered to mention it. William Michaels is quite a talent. I produced a concert and recording for William. September 17th, 2001, which was a disastrous time to produce anything. Mm-hmm. And William is such a great talent, and I'm glad to see he's out there working. Please tell him I said hello.
It's a deal.
All righty. So everybody, enjoy your week. Come back, see us next week. Go to BroadwayRadio.com for show notes and contact information to reach us. You can listen to us on iTunes. Please, please, please download us on iTunes because it helps us, and Apple will promote us, and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. That way you won't miss anything. Every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded for you. And listen to us on Broadway World Radio Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. And I think that covers everything. Twitter, Facebook, all the other stuff's on BroadwayRadio.com. And have a great week. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Make a blunder, make a gaff, make them wonder, make them laugh. Ride up, 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 up. Don't be shy, don't be slow.